The views expressed in the preceding program do not necessarily reflect the views of CKLN Radio Incorporated.
Have a service or product you want the public to know about?
Then advertise with CKLN 88.1 FM. Call sales at 416-979-5251, extension 2373.
Our diverse multicultural music and spoken word programming is streamed and broadcast 24/7 to the GTA and is heard throughout Southern Ontario on Rogers 947.
We can be heard on the web at www.ckln.fm.
Contact our sales office weekdays, Monday to Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m.
Or drop in at 55 Gould Street at Church, second floor in the Ryerson Student Campus Center.
To advertise your product or service with CKLN, email advertising@ckln.fm.
Or call sales at 416-979-5251, extension 2373.
CKLN, celebrating 25 years of independent radio.
Good night, Susie. I'm Paul Kangas, wishing all of you the best of goodbyes.
Well, it's cold outside, and we're back.
What is the temperature there, Greg?
I have no idea. It's a bit chilly today.
Do you have snow?
There's a little bit of a dusting of snow about, yes.
Is there a Christmas spirit in the air?
None.
Are you being affected by the economy in the States?
Hard to say at the moment. I think we had a very, very bad jobs report this past week. And if you factored it in, if you say that the United States has 10 times the number of people that we do, and you multiplied our numbers, ours were much bigger than the United States unemployment numbers for that particular month. So
bigger ratio.
Yeah, if you made ours, like I said, we've got about 30 some odd million people. They've got, what, 320, 330 million
yeah.
people. We're about 10% of their population, and they said it was a disastrous jobs report. They didn't really say that here, but if you multiply the numbers, it was pretty bad. I mean, obviously, we're going to get affected, and of course, I don't know whether you know this, Bob, but the Harper government got a pierogi or something. I always thought that was a food, but they've got pieroged, or in other words, they don't have to show up and do their job for a whole month. And they got away, and Harper seems to have gotten away with avoiding a coalition government. Now everybody's running away from that thing. Hold on a second. I'm going to go to this caller. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you? It's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart. How are you?
I'm all right. What's going on?
Well, we're carrying on beyond our time.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
At least you ended the show correctly.
I did. I have not been ending the show properly for ages, and I, you know, because of, you know, and then somebody runs in, and you go a little bit longer, and then you have to end the show a little bit too abruptly. I thought I'm just going to do that in a positive manner, just to get it done.
Manner.
In a timely manner, when I had 5 minutes.
Now, I tuned in around 9:20, and I missed what got you on this Walt Disney kick, but it was really interesting what you were saying about Walt Disney.
Yeah, well, actually, one of the former people who used to broadcast here sent me a quote of Walt Disney, and I assume it was a Wikipedia quote because of Walt Disney's birthday was December 5th, which just happens to be the same birthday as my late father. And so I always think about my father on that day, and then I also think about Walt Disney because Walt Disney is a big hero of mine. And even though it would appear as if ideologically we differed quite a bit, but that's really what it was. And it was about the quote that this person sent me, which was appropriate to something that we were discussing at the time, was this. I'll read it again. He talked about leadership, and at least around, just giving a bit of history, I suppose, talking about organizations that I've been involved with, sometimes the word leader has been sullied, that you don't need a leader, that leaders are bad. Well, I don't really agree with that. I never have, and I've considered whether leaders are bad. Of course, bad leaders create bad situations, but I've been able to see organizations that run without leadership, and I've found them to be disastrous. And you need someone with some kind of an idea about what to do that makes sense. And I think Walt Disney summed it up quite nicely in this quote that was the Wikipedia quote of the day, I guess, on December 5th, the day that he was born, celebrating that day. Leadership means that a group, large or small, is willing to entrust authority to a person who has shown judgment, wisdom, personal appeal, and proven competence. And I can't argue with that. I mean, obviously, that embodies Walt Disney, and he probably knew that. But because Walt Disney, if anything, of all of those things, I would say personal appeal, almost anybody who's met Walt Disney felt that he was an extremely affable and friendly person, and seemed to be very genuine about that. Although a lot of the cartoonists caricatured him looking very miserable with one eyebrow lifted up. But that seemed to be more of worry than anything else. But
I'd always read that he ran his fun factory like a prison camp.
Well, I don't know where you read that, but I guess the story that might be closest to that was just when they were trying to finish Snow White. When they were trying to finish that movie, it was such a push, and it had never been done before, such a large-scale animated cartoon film. And he was setting the standard so high, creating such amazing images, and the amount of work that was involved in having to do this was massive, beyond, I suppose, what even he thought would be the case. That the people were really working round the clock, and there were no union at that time there, but people were into it because at least the people that I've met that worked on it, they just believed in what he was doing. He evidently one night years before, he had called everybody for a meeting in the evening. And he got up and he performed the entire story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves for everybody. He did it from start to finish.
Wasn't that typical of how he would basically pitch film projects to his staff in general?
Yeah, well,
tell them the story and
performing. Yes, he was a master story person. He knew what was important in a story and how to portray it. And he worked with everybody and did it in a very professional way. They have transcripts of all of the meetings they had, and they're just fascinating to read them talking, how seriously they're talking about the characters in the cartoon and how they really believe in it. Whereas I think a lot of the times that I've been involved in films, there's a cynical aspect to it where people aren't really, they're putting down in a sense what they're doing. They don't think very deeply about the characters and so on. And that just wasn't going on there. They were really, Disney instilled the idea that it was fun, but that there was, you had to think about what you were doing and put like the Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, those characters didn't have individual personalities in the original story. They were just a group of seven little dwarves and seven little men. And he came up with the idea of giving them each a name that was somehow indicative of their personality. It sounds simple now, but that's what made that picture, you know. That's what gave it, instead of just seven little men running around doing things, this was seven individual characters who had something to offer you can't watch that film and see the grumpy character and how he gets turned around by Snow White. Really, no decent human being could watch that and not feel something inside of themselves that... it's just nice. It's a nice feeling to watch that. And of course, he knew that you had to develop that feeling that even the grumpiest person would be enchanted by Snow White and her ways, because then you wouldn't care about her and what would happen to her. It's these Disney, one of the stories I meant to go into in a little bit of depth, which I didn't, during the Cold War time and post-war, during the blacklist, there was a man who was blacklisted from working in motion pictures. And what some people did was they either worked under a pseudonym or they would get somebody else to front for them. In fact, I think Woody Allen made a film called The Front.
The Front's a great one, yeah.
And
the director of The Front, what was his name, Martin?
Martin Ritt?
Yeah, he was blacklisted.
Right. And Martin, but this I can't remember the name of this particular person, but this man got his wife, who wasn't in the film business at all, to front for him. And one of the films, and she did this for a while, he would write everything. She would go to the meetings, take notes, come home, tell him what was going on at the meeting, and he would write the script. But eventually, she learned so much about how the film business worked and how about screenwriting and so on, she started to write her own screenplays. And one of them was for a Walt Disney film in the late 50s. And this was printed, I think, in American Cinematographer or one of the American film magazines. And one of the, I think the most fascinating thing for me in this was how emotional Disney was. And some people would think this is an emotional illness or something, but he would, when he would be listening to a her reading the screenplay, she would bring it in and she'd start reading it. He'd ask her to read sections from it, and he would sit there, and his men, you know, yes men would be around there, and Disney would be sitting there, and she'd be reading, and then she'd realize she'd hear some whimpering, and she'd look up, and Disney'd be crying at some emotional part of this screenplay that she was reading. And he would say, oh, you know, carry on. He'd have a handkerchief up, and he'd be wiping his eyes. And these yes men would all do the same thing, but it wasn't genuine with them. He really felt it. And he he'd invite her, and he called her by a nickname. He'd pick an endearing little nickname, and he would use that for her, and then he invited her to the screening of the film, and he was always very pleasant, always very nice to her, and he was at the screening. She was at the screening of the final film. She was sitting right behind Disney, and they ran the film. The lights went up, and he turned around, and he was just, there were tears running down his face, and he says, that was beautiful. And that's something you never read about Walt Disney in the official material, that he was really governed by his emotionalism to, if it hit him, if it somehow got some kind of a reaction, that was good enough for him. And that's why he says in some of these quotes how corny he is. I think that's what he's referring to, that he finds sort of body humor, because he found that funny. It's, you know, he says if somebody's getting highbrow around here, they get kicked out of the studio. In the sense, he had a lowbrow humor sense, but also he was deeply sensitive about emotional issues. And I think this is what makes the Disney films. When I talk about the Disney films, I'm talking about the films that he was involved in.
I think what's interesting with Disney as a company is they're almost just a model of the Hollywood film industry in general, is that Disney, under Walt Disney, believed that the way to create successful commercial films was to make them good, basically. They believed that was a tenet of their philosophy, was that the product needed to actually be good. And the Michael Eisner era reflects a completely different mentality that's also reflected in the wider Hollywood industry, is that the films, the quality of the films is meaningless in comparison to the formulaic ways in which the films are marketed based on demographic research and various other things that don't necessarily relate to the inherent entertainment value of the movies.
You look at any of the Disney films that were made during his time, and his time would have been between the 1920s and when he died in 1966. And really, it's hard to look at many of the films and say that they were carbon copy or cookie cutter approach, especially the animated films, and certainly most of the live action films. But really, he's best known for his, I think anyway, for the animated films. They're not very similar at all. They're very, very different and often very experimental. The only film that I can really think of that was similar to another, which Disney ultimately considered a failure, and it was one of the most biggest budgeted films he ever made, was Sleeping Beauty, which has a lot of similarities to Snow White, except done up in a huge fashion with very, very stylized artwork in it by an artist named Ivan Earl. And, you know, he spent a vast amount of money in it. And when I see it as someone who's been involved in animation, it's just a stunning piece of work throughout. It's not, it maybe isn't a great film, but it's it maybe shouldn't have been made. It's retrogressive, the fairy tale. Maybe he should have been moving away from that at that time, but this is what he threw all that money into, because and it's just the effort and the detail and everything about it. It's at the highest level of technically.
So Sleeping Beauty was a disappointment financially?
Yes, I think it was. And in fact, it he then moved away from animation personally. Disney decided not to be involved because of that film. He decided to move away from it, and he cut down the animation department, laid off many, many, many people. And of course, Sleeping Beauty came out at the time when the television era was really getting into high gear, and Disney was changing with the times. Spending at the time, I think Sleeping Beauty cost $6 million to make, which doesn't sound like a lot of money now, but it would definitely be well over $100, $150 million type of movie today, you know, from an inflation standpoint. And then the next film was 101 Dalmatians, which when I saw it, and I saw it as an adult or a young man in England, I didn't see it as a child. I hardly saw any of the Disney films as a child, except if they ran on television. I remember I was interested in animation. I was with my father, and he was very encouraging to me about being in animation. But I remember we were on a bus on Eglinton Avenue going by the Golden Mile, and there was the Golden Mile Cinema there. And I remember looking over, and it said, Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And I said, Dad, maybe I should go and see that. And he says, no. He says, I wouldn't. He says, I'd just stick with the Bugs Bunnies. And so I saw the Disney features mainly as a young man when I got into the business. I don't think I'd ever seen Snow White until I was 17 years old, 17 or 18 years old, and Pinocchio or any of those Disney features, even though I was very, very involved in animation. And, of course, you have to remember, at that time, films only came out every 7 years. Disney would release them generationally, and you know, once they'd release it for children who were, you know, in their 7, 8 years old, and then 7 years later, they'd be out again for the next crop of 7 or 8 years old.
The very first movie I ever saw in a movie theater was Dumbo.
Yes, that was one of the first features I saw on television. That was the only one that he ran on television on the Walt Disney Show 2 weeks in a row in about 1962 or 63, I think. Could have been a bit later, but I remember seeing Dumbo, which is a very short film. I think it's just over 60 minutes long, and it's considered to be perhaps the best film that Disney ever made. It certainly is. The sequence with the mother elephant and the baby elephant and the where she's been imprisoned and
it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's and
released
Disney
1941, Greg.
1941. And Disney, of course, this is the work of a lot of people. It isn't just Walt Disney. But when Disney's gone, the heart goes away. Those sort of moments seem to disappear because it's because he, I think, that was his gift. That was what he was a freak in many ways. He could feel this sentiment, and he understood the emotions of the audience. For instance, in Pinocchio, at the end of the film, when the puppet becomes a boy, and Geppetto is mourning the loss of his son, Pinocchio. And he doesn't realize that he thinks Pinocchio's dead because he's found him dead and brought him back to his shop. And they're mourning him. And the fairy comes down and brings Pinocchio to life again. And it's you know, you're sad for Geppetto because he's lost his son, this creation of his, this puppet that came to life. And then you're sad. Then the puppet comes to life, but Geppetto's still sad. And the little boy, now he's a little boy, and he says, "But father, I'm alive, I'm alive." And he, and Geppetto says, no, Pinocchio, you're dead. And it's this combination of the sadness and the humor together that just rips you around emotionally. You don't know what you should be feeling, and it makes you cry.
I think the great master of that was also Charles Chaplin.
Yes,
his films had the same quality, that same heartbreaking pathos.
And Chaplin was a great admirer of Walt Disney, and Disney of Chaplin as well.
I'd like to invite you on my show sometime to do a Walt Disney tribute.
Sure, we should work on that.
Right?
Yeah, that'd be great, Stuart.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
And do it soon.
Okay.
All right.
Cheers. Bye.
All right, bye-bye.
That's Stuart Feedback Andrews, who is the host of a program called Cinephobia, which is on Fridays at 2 p.m., starting at 2 p.m. Fridays here on CKLN. So
he called it Cinephobia.
Cinephobia. I think because his main interest was in like horror movies. And I think that was going to be the drift originally of his program, but I think it significantly changed from there and has a wider scope, as you would see there, unless he knows of the origins or the whereabouts of a Disney slasher movie. But
I remember you had him on a few months ago with some filmmaker or something. He was a guest on your show with another person.
Yes, yes, and we did an impromptu recording session right on the air.
Yeah, and actually, we heard you do your voices. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So 416-595-1655, if you want to chime in here, we're in the extended time. Last week, the host who usually frequents this particular spot wrote to me early in the morning. I didn't get the email until I got home, but she said that she had fallen ill. So I hope she's feeling better. And we are now extending into this particular slot. Now,
we can develop all kinds of themes here we've had callers, they've raised issues, they get dropped, we move on to others. We can think about what people said and develop them.
True.
Or do we move forward with new influence, new stimulation?
I have to look and see what new stimulation I have here. Let's see. What have I got? I have all kinds of things. I was going to do this at another time, but it might be interesting to do now.
Well, I like your topics that you find.
Thank you. Let me look. Oh yeah, the tachistoscope. I've been putting that off for weeks.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Now, there's a caller that often phones up, and her name is Heather, and she brings
hey,
up.
Hey, Greg, I just have to look at the Comrades chat portal. I haven't looked at it.
Yeah,
the guy didn't know we're on the radio. He goes, "What Pellegrino? What radio? From
yeah,
Torino."
Yeah, they don't know. People just are going in there now and finding it by accident. And I'm trying to inform him, but he doesn't really understand. Bob, if you want to write to him, if you get a moment there while I'm speaking,
yeah,
just try and explain to this person. He says he's from Torino. That's in Italy, right?
Right.
I think. I mean, unless he's spelling Toronto wrong. Spelling seems to be such a challenge for so many people, and that we now have to interpret what people are saying. But we have to factor in for their lack of ability with spelling and grammar and fill in words and it's just it's a strange world we live in now. I mean, obviously,
Phoenix Wake.
I guess so.
Every word's misspelled.
I guess that does have a relevancy to this, doesn't it?
It does. You like that tone? It does.
Yes, thank you, Bob. Thank you. Now, Getting back to Heather, Heather often phones in and chimes in with some topics here and there, and always interesting, always well, something that we...
She thinks that the Zionist cartel should be Chinese water dripped on everybody 24/7. She wants to stay on that story.
Yes, she's very concentrated on that, and that is her... her obsession, I suppose. That's her interest. That's her. And she feels, I think, that there's a. She's calling out to everybody, warning them, like the, like a canary in a coal mine, or like a screaming around the guy in the
like Bob
the,
Marshall who started this show.
Yeah, like the invasion of the body snatchers. They're coming to get us. The pods. They're coming to get us. You don't
like
understand.
Bob,
you know,
like
Kevin McCarthy racing. Kevin McCarthy racing through the streets in the cars trying to stop oncoming traffic, and he's telling everybody, the pods are coming, they're coming, they're here to get us!
Like Alex Jones. Do you know that Anton Leo and John Jones told Bob Marshall, why don't you just go stand in front of Sam the Record Man and put a sign up? They thought it was spoken word. They were music programmers. They thought spoken word in 1984 was absurd on CKLM. They told them to get off, forget being on CKLM, go stand on the corner.
Well, in some ways, it would have more of an effect, but you'd be well known if you did that year, day after day, year after year, decade after decade. You'd be a legend, and then you'd die, and you'd be thought of as a wacko.
But you'd have no community.
No,
you'd just be a figure. Yeah. Like that Ben guy. He used to come down to the Bob Marshall Show in the middle '80s and donate. You remember the guy?
Oh yeah, yeah. I voted for him. He ran for mayor. Ben Kerr. Ben Kerr.
He offered a healthy drink or something.
Yeah, Ben Kerr.
Yeah.
I liked him.
He was known. Known to sit on that corner, Blungen Blur.
Yep.
Blungen Gur, right?
Yes. What did you say?
Blungen Gur.
Blungen Gur. So Heather brought up this topic a while back, and... because the phone technology is imprecise, people say things, and you imagine in your mind in the print-oriented world what that would be spelled like, and sometimes we have a hard time. Sometimes people are pronouncing something. They may be saying it right, but you're interpreting it wrong, and nobody's spelling things out. You're not getting – and I, for years I was saying, can you send me this information by email? Please, or a letter, something, or send me the documentation about this.
And of course, tell you to look it up yourself.
Yeah, look it up yourself. So, and I go and I look it up based on how I think it's spelled. And in this case, it was something she called a what I thought was a schistoscope, or a schistoscope, or something. And I'd look this thing up. I'd really do some due diligence on this, and I'd come up with nothing, absolutely nothing. But the premise of this this schistoscope or whatever she was calling it was that somehow there was a technology that had been developed by some man in the 40s, and it somehow would encode motion picture film in such a way that it would be sending out hidden signals to people when it was projected, and that it would have an effect on people, that they would go and do things, or it'd be a mass hypnosis type of device or medium. And it was used in motion pictures all the time. So, and I suppose once you say it's being used in motion pictures, then motion pictures are transferred to television. So, and these, you'd think that these things are ingrained in the images of the negatives of these films. So given her theory, then there's nonstop propaganda going on a subliminal basis, let alone what's being worked out carefully in terms of the films themselves one way or another, that there's something that we just don't even have any control over. We're seeing things and we're not actually noticing that we're seeing them. It's a frightening thought. So... she brought, but I countered, because I guess the running theme of this particular program is that we've been talking about my involvement in the film industry.
Yeah, because we're not talking about the community today.
Right, we're not. I said this is ridiculous. I've worked in the film business. I've worked with all kinds of people who worked on motion pictures, And I've worked, I've seen the process from the beginning to the end, what happens at the laboratory, what happens in optical printers, animation. I mean, I'm doing frame-by-frame animation. I mean, is there anything more manipulative than that over the motion picture medium? I mean, it's as contrived as you could possibly get. It's not like taking a movie camera out and start shooting some film. When you make an animated film, you're crafting almost every single frame. And you're deciding how long each individual shot is. You're designing this, or should be. It's hard to be terribly spontaneous in that regard when you're making an animated film. You got to plan it out a little bit, or a lot, which live action can be done the same way, but sometimes it's done a little less rigidly. So Heather would come on and talk about this thing, this device, and I'd say, this is impossible. This doesn't exist. Get me the information and let me look at it, and I'll determine whether this is even technically possible to do, to somehow. And she didn't provide many details. Well, I did some more due diligence just to show you how much I spend time working on this show and working out the concerns of my listeners. Well, I found what it is. It's called a tachistoscope. T-A-C-H, for you print-oriented bees out there, T-A-C-H-I-S-T-O-S-C-O-P-E, the tachistoscope. And I have I found this online by Robert S. Owen, and I even wrote to Dr. Owen to see whether he would come on the program, and he thought I was a loony, I guess, and never got in touch with me. Now, this is his theory here. Imagine the power of an advertiser who could put persuasive thoughts into your mind without your conscious awareness. This is the idea behind the so-called subliminal advertising. According to some popular accounts, movie theaters can sneak frames into the movie that flash, "Eat popcorn," and the audience, supposedly unaware of having read this message, will comply and buy more popcorn. The idea is that the message is displayed for such a short period of time that the viewer does not have time to consciously process it, and so is therefore not consciously aware of ever having seen the message. According to proponents of this idea, the viewer will nonetheless process the message at some level below consciousness, and thereby act upon it. At first blush, this notion sounds very possible. After all, a great proportion of our mental processes and subsequent behaviors happen at a level that is below our level of awareness, even though these can be consciously controlled, like breathing, eye blinking, scratching a nose. Have you ever been in a crowded room at a noisy party? Imagine that you are involved in a conversation with a few friends, totally unaware of what is being said in the conversations of dozens of groups around you. Then you suddenly hear your name mentioned in a conversation three groups away, and your heart steps up its pace just a little as you wonder what they were saying about you. Ah, here is solid evidence that we do indeed process information at a level that is below our everyday levels of consciousness, and that this information is being monitored in a way that can immediately affect our conscious thoughts and behavior. Oh, this is called the cocktail party phenomenon. This is what he says. However, if it really is possible to unconsciously influence people's thoughts and behaviors in advertising, the word would certainly be out and every advertiser would be doing it. Consultants who know how to do this stuff would be making lots of money giving seminars on how to do it. Indeed, why give seminars at all? Why not just directly tap that unconscious part of our brain and directly feed the information into memory? The reason is that the multiple ways that our brain processes information is not so simple, and we appear to have a lot of different kinds of processors and preprocessors. For example, there is some preprocessing that filters out multiple conversations at a party as a way to keep our main processor, consciousness, from becoming overloaded with information. The preprocessor is too small to hold very much, so it immediately flushes apparently useless information into a shredder. Any useful piece of information, such as a mention of our name, is passed along, but we cannot recall any other contextual information, no matter how hard we try, because it has already been flushed and shredded. We cannot. I feel like Jennifer Zaytover here right now, Bob. I know you'll know what I'm talking about there, but the old Ex Libris show on CKLN.
20 years ago, Greg.
Yeah. We cannot find any practical evidence that subliminal advertising works, and yet we do know that preconscious processing systems exist. The possibility that we could figure out how to tap these preconscious processes for financial gain or for more wholesome processes or purposes, such as improved learning in school, makes this an intriguing area for study, albeit frustrating. Below is one way that has also been used to study this fascinating topic. The tachistoscope. You knew I was going to get to it at some point, didn't you? Is an instrument that can flash information before our eyes for a very small and precise amounts of time. There are two basic types, a flash tube tachistoscope and the shutter tachistoscope. The flash tube T-scope uses a small lamp that is something of a cross between the fluorescent tube in ceiling lights and the flash tube used in camera. The flash tube in a T-scope has very fast rise and fall times in how fast it reaches maximum brightness and how fast it turns off, and it can be kept on for very precise amounts of time. This makes it possible to light up an image for a few milliseconds at a time. So it goes on and describes all the different types of tachistoscopes that there are. And the bottom line here is that and you can download a tachistoscope. And this brought to mind that and he goes on to say that that the tachistoscopes that are set up, a lot of them involve very high quality imagery, slide presentations and so on, where there'll be multiple projectors projecting different images, and they do use these in focus groups to wire people up and get their impressions and reactions to certain imagery being presented to them. And it also brought my mind back to something that I've always remembered, which I think is interesting. And I have no idea whether it was a tachistoscope or something like that. But I remember in grade 1, and it might have been grade 2, but I'm pretty sure it was in very, very early time in school for me, they brought in this machine. And what it would do, and I've never seen this machine ever again, but they brought in this piece of technology, and they had to turn the lights down in the room, and we would all sit around this machine, and it would highlight or flash different words in a sentence. It would be like a light crossing a sentence, and sometimes the area of light would get smaller or larger. At first, it would be larger. You'd see more of the sentence in front of you at first, and it would be moving very slowly. And you would be asked by the teacher to read the sentence. And you'd start off, and this light would move across, revealing this lettering. And but it'd be a projector that would have a mask that would reveal what was on the frame, on the glass projection. And at first, of course, you could read the thing fairly easily. Then what they'd do is they'd reduce the mask size, and they would speed up how this reveal was occurring with this particular sentence. And you'd go to another sentence. And I guess what it was meant to do was to try and help you with reading more quickly and being more attentive to words and to see how quickly your mind could process this. And that's very much what a tachistoscope is. In fact, the one that I downloaded from the internet was flashing words in front of me, and you could set a different rate. And indeed, tachistoscopes are used for speed reading, for practicing speed reading, so that your when your eye is scanning across words on a page, it's like you're flashing, like you're picking them up bit by bit. And so anyway, that's the tachistoscope. Now it was created in the 1800s. So the idea that the guy who created it he made this thing and then he was murdered, well, I don't have any information about that. But and many people believe that this subliminal advertising is at least the New York Times, in an article from 1982 by Jane E. Brody, Is subliminal persuasion a menace? And according to this article, evidently not. And it goes to say, a quarter of a century after the issue was first raised, battles rage anew over the power of subliminal perception and how extensively this means of hidden persuasion may be used to affect human behaviors and feelings. Public concern is focused on such 1984 questions as whether people are influenced by invisible exhortations to, again, they mention here, quote-unquote, eat popcorn flashed between the frames of movie films, or whether the word sex is imprinted in microscopic type on every Ritz cracker to make the crackers more appealing, or whether minds are being manipulated by inaudible messages broadcast among the sounds of Muzak. Most major advertisers have disavowed the use of subliminal techniques, though it is impossible to verify their contention since, by definition, subliminal messages are beyond the limits of conscious perception. Amid claims and counterclaims for the power and persuasiveness of subliminal techniques, little scientific evidence has accumulated to show that either exists. Nearly all studies asserting a dramatic effect of subliminally presented information have failed the crucial test of scientific replication. A number of psychologists are now challenging the very notion that people can be influenced in any way by messages they cannot consciously see or hear. Their studies show that even when people are exposed repeatedly to readily detectable messages, they fail to learn the information if their attention is directed to other information presented simultaneously. This is reminiscent of the cocktail party effect. Again, this is mentioned. We're seeing repeats from Dr. Owen's work here, in which one can hear several simultaneous conversations, but the content of all but one conversation fails to register. At the same time, however, a New York psychologist working with subliminal visual messages that are shown without an overlay of visible messages reports that not only does the subliminal information affect behavior, but it can also be used to enhance the effectiveness of therapy and to simulate learning. He has found subliminal influences to be potentially so effective that he fears their uncontrolled use could be dangerous. The extent to which these findings are in conflict and whether such conflict can be resolved awaits further research. Meanwhile, according to Dr. Timothy E. Moore, chairman of the Department of Psychology at York University in Toronto, Bob, very important place, the, quote, the important, I'll do my professor voice, the important question is not whether subliminal perception is a legitimate phenomenon, but whether the generalizations that have been made to advertising effects are warranted by the findings in subliminal perception. It's a hopeless mismatch. They are not talking at all about the same phenomenon. Dr. Moore explained that highly contrived artificial laboratory settings are required for studying subliminal perception, settings wholly different from the context of an advertisement, movie, or broadcast. He described the laboratory responses as fragile, transitory, and relatively primitive, and as having nothing whatever to do with the covert manipulation of behavior. There's my scientist.
Excellent, Greg. Excellent.
Thank
excellent.
You. For example, in the controversial New York studies conducted by Dr. Lloyd H. Silverman, a research psychologist. I hope I get to do an impersonation of Lloyd H. Silverman, doctor. A research psychologist at the Veterans Administration regional office, people sit in a quiet, darkened room and peer into an instrument called a tachistoscope. Subliminal messages and pictures appear as flashes of light across the visual field. That does sound like what I was talking about with my little experience as a child, doesn't it?
Yep.
Although people do not know what message they have seen, Dr. Silverman says that different responses result depending on the person and the nature of the messages. Thus, when Dr. Silverman exposed schizophrenic patients to the subliminal message, people arguing, their schizophrenic symptoms temporarily intensified. But when the message flashed was, "Mommy and I are one," the patient's symptoms abated. This finding, Dr. Silverman says, is consistent with the psychoanalytic view that the symptoms of schizophrenia partly reflect an unconscious conflict over aggressive impulses, and that schizophrenics, among others, have a subconscious wish to unite with a benevolent mother figure. Only male schizophrenics responded positively to the mommy message. Female schizophrenics improved when the message was changed to daddy and I are one. Those who received an innocuous message like people are walking showed no behavioral change, Dr. Silverman reported.
Walk the talk.
Yeah, walk the talk. Here, let me play that. Let me find that. Walk the talk.
If only Danny was here.
Here, yeah, it'd be there. It'd be there. But here.
Walk the talk. Walk the talk. I like that saying.
In an interview, he said that dozens of experiments done by himself and others, including several independent investigators, showed the far-reaching power of subliminal messages. When used as an adjunct to a stop-smoking program, the subliminal mommy message significantly increased the number of people who remained ex-smokers. The mommy message enhanced weight losses achieved by women participating in a behavior modification weight control program. In another study, college students who saw the mommy message did much better on their final exams. Maybe I need to see a mommy message before I do the show. Maybe I need to speak to my mommy before I do the show.
You need to flash it at board meetings.
Yeah, mommy. 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 Mommy and I are one. The studies, at least it's someone, I mean, at least your mother. We all have a mother, right? Don't we?
Yep.
Do you have a mother?
No.
Oh, okay.
No comment.
All right. The studies were done in a double-blind fashion so that neither the subject nor the researcher knew which message was flashed until after the results were analyzed. Although several scientists have replicated the Silverman results, others question their reproducibility. For one, Dr. Kurt Heilbrun, of course, I would expect Dr. Kurt Heilbrun to challenge Dr. Silverman's studies. A psychologist at Florida State University was unable to verify Dr. Silverman's results in a dart-throwing experiment using the messages beating daddy is wrong and beating daddy is okay, accompanied by subliminal messages, pictures of father and son smiling or frowning. Dr. Silverman found that the okay message improved performance and the wrong message diminished it. Dr. Heilbrun found no such effect.
There was a complete absence of results from any message,
Dr. Heilbrun said in an interview.
There is some doubt in my mind as to whether such an effect exists, or how strong it is, or whether Silverman gets his results for the reasons he says he does. It could be that his subjects are responding to artifacts or to the subliminal pictures he flashes along with his messages.
That's Dr. Heilbrun, by the way. Dr. Heilbrun noted that in the Silverman studies, the four-word message was flashed in 4 milliseconds and repeated 4 times.
It is not possible to decode such a message, he said.
Dr. Moore concurs, especially with regard to messages supposedly used in advertising. Is that Dr. Moore earlier? Was I doing Dr. Moore? I didn't think his name was Dr. Moore. Hold on, I got to check. I got to check whether that's Dr. Moore because I have to go back to that voice. Let's see. Yeah, it is. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go back. I think it's Dr. Moore. Okay, I'm going to go back now, and I will replicate. Dr. Moore. Dr. Moore concurs, especially with regard to messages supposedly used in advertising.
To have some behavioral effect, a message has to be extracted, processed, and registered somewhere. When it comes to subliminal messages, that's a very tall order. The message may be backwards or minuscule and can't be perceived in any legitimate sense of the word perception. If meaning can't be extracted, how can a message have its intended influence?
In studies recently completed at Ohio State University, another doctor, they're just endless of these people, huh? Dr. Anthony Greenwald and Gary Kidd showed that people were unable to remember an audible series of numbers that were repeated along with information they were told to remember. Oh, gosh, I got to do Dr. Greenwald. Well, let me think.
This means there is no memory without attention,
Dr. Greenwald said.
It's consistent with the possibility of learning a foreign language while sleeping if it is played on a tape recorder.
What then of the claim that the subliminal coding of the word sex, 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 in advertisements increases the consumer's desire for the product? In three books, Subliminal Seduction, Media Sexploitation, and the Clam Plate Orgy, I want to say clamp it, Clam Plate Orgy, Wilson Brian Key, a Canadian journalism professor, popularized the notion that subliminal sexual images were widely used in advertising. Dr. Moore, getting back to Dr. Moore again, argues that holding advertisers responsible for one's erotic musings is analogous to accusing Rorschach of insinuating particular themes into the ink blots. Furthermore, he said, under ordinary circumstances, and adds, supraliminal content will receive the lion's share of attention, if it receives any attention at all. What you see is what you get. He added. Dr. Stephen Kelly, or J. Stephen Kelly, a marketing specialist at DePaul University, agrees that very probably the total
make him British.
No, he's at DePaul University. Very probably the total impression of an ad illustration overpowers any embedded subliminal content. Still, several studies have indicated that some effect, though not necessarily the expected one, can result from subliminal exposures. One study flashed the word beef subliminally during a short movie. Those who were exposed to beef did not differ from a control group later in their preference for beef or in verbal references to beef, but they did report being hungrier. Similarly, an increase in thirst was noted after subliminal exposure to the word Coke. These findings could have been due to chance, Dr. Moore said, but even if they are taken at face value, their relevance to advertising is minimal. The psychologist James V. McConnell has concluded that... Oh, I have to do him? Okay, he'll be British, all right? All things considered, secret attempts to manipulate people's minds have yielded results as subliminal as the stimuli used. And speaking for the American Association of Advertising Agencies last year, Charles F. Adams said, "We are convinced that there is no subliminal advertising in America today. Advertising people learned long ago that the best way to say a thing is to say it up front, on top, and above board, where it belongs." So there you have it. That's our little look into the tachistoscope. And I have... Yes, I'm sorry, Bob. It's very important. I have to play this message.
Okay. Here's one concert you won't want to miss. On Saturday, December 13th, 2008, Common Thread is having a benefit concert for L'Arche Toronto, a vibrant community in the Danforth and Riverdale neighborhoods where adults with development disabilities live, work, and create a home together.
This event by Common Thread, a community voice of Toronto, 70-voice choir rooted in folk music traditions from around the world with special guest artists, sweet time, and a performance by L'Arche Toronto, Soul Express, is just $15, or pay what you can.
Located at Kimburn Park United Church, 200 Wolverley Boulevard.
Tickets to Common Thread's multicultural repertoire from around the world, please contact
www.commonthreadchorus.ca or phone 416-410-5022. Visa and MasterCard are accepted.
Excuse me one moment. That was a commercial.
Well, this is a commercial radio station.
Well, you can't have commercials on radio, dash it all. What are the listeners going to think?
Indeed, what are the listeners going to think? I have no idea. 416-595-1655. If I'm having trouble in taking your calls, I'll let you in on a little something that happened this week. Now, I don't like to go into detail about what I do here every Sunday. I know I probably sometimes do, and it's annoying. But I do a little elaborate setup before I do the program, and it's to make the show a little bit easier for me to do. It's a little bit easier for me to... I set up little lights, and that inform me, that are in within my field of vision, that I can see when a call is coming in. Now, you'd think that that would be sort of intuitive, wouldn't you? That you, if you're taking calls, if you're here on the air, you're looking over, let's say, at the computer or working on the board, that you might want to see a light that's in your field of vision. Now, right now, actually, right at this moment, as I'm speaking to you, the light is going on the phones. And just because I was sort of taking a moment out to talk to you about this.
You just read there. It took about half an hour, and you did all the impressions, and they're very good, actually, is that you have a bunch of doctors that are arguing on both sides of the question. So it took you half an hour to say that there's no conclusion to it. Is that what I'm supposed to get from that half an hour?
Huh? Oh, sorry.
Of that long thesis or scientific article that you read, does it work or not?
The tachistoscope?
The subliminal advertising.
My premise has been, when this caller phones in and talks about the tachistoscope and how there are films that are used to change our minds and that there is an insidious tool that's used, my premise has always been that this doesn't exist, that it doesn't happen, that it isn't a technology, and I've never heard about it, and so on. Now, there is such a thing called a tachistoscope, and I took the half hour. I'm sorry I took that time out of your life, but I found these articles, and because it's been discussed on the air, and we have long discussions where there's no data at all, I don't think that it's my job to tell you what you should think, except that you should become a Stalinist. Now, I've decided that the best form of government is Stalinism, and I think you should be an adherent. I've come to that conclusion. I've told you that. Now, if I were to tell you that, are you going to be following along with me in this venture?
Well, I might. You never know.
Well, do you? No. I don't want any here or there about it. I want you to either decide right now whether you are or not. I mean, that's what you're saying to me, that I've spent a half an hour.
You know what, Greg? I have discovered that I've been listening to your show on and off for, I don't know, 3-4 years.
Yeah.
And I have discovered that a lot of talking points or platitudes or concepts about Stalinism, whatever it is, and Marxism and stuff,
yes,
are sometimes consistent with what I have always thought.
Good.
There's sometimes I think things that I thought it was just me, and then I'll hear you or Greg or Bob, I mean you or it was the other guy, Daniel,
yeah.
I'll say that, and I'll say to myself, well, I've always thought that, but you know, I never heard it echoed with anybody else that I've ever known. So for me to tell you now that, yes, okay, I'm a Stalinist. Hey, I could say it.
That was good. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's halfway there, just being able to say it.
Emotional motivation, it just gets it out there sometimes when you're motivated.
So you were...
I don't know. Like, I agree with some of the stuff, but I think to brush myself with that broad stroke, I couldn't do that right now because, like I say, I always hear things that other people have said, and then I discover that I agree with them on that.
But weren't you phoning me up really sort of, I don't know whether you were berating me or chastising me or calling me to task. Were you saying, like there was a half an hour radio, you were saying, what are we supposed to take from this? And
yeah.
Okay.
Like, were you trying to say that it happens or were you trying to say that it doesn't happen because you gave us a bunch of differing viewpoints about it?
Well, I think
Supposedly educated, learned men.
Well, I think that if you go to a movie theater, I'll give you an example from my life. You go to, as a child, around this time of year in 1967, I went to see really the first, beside Fantasia, the first animated feature film I'd ever seen in my life. In a movie theater. Again, I think I'd seen what the heck are you doing over there?
Oh, I'm cooking.
Oh, you're cooking. Okay, I'll pot you down there for a moment. I'll leave you. It's good ambient noise. I went to see Jungle Book in 1967. It was an extremely cold day. We went down to the Birch Cliff Cinema, which I don't know whether it's still there. It was down in Scarborough. And went with a bunch of other kids. It was during the day. And walked from the cold right into this theater that was just steaming hot. And... The screen started up, the movie started up, and it was a movie about being in a jungle. And to me, I later saw the film in an air-conditioned cinema, and it just didn't have the same effect for me. It was right. having that steamy atmosphere and watching these images where they were trying to get some atmosphere going with the idea that you were in a jungle. Right. It has an effect of it. Does it make you feel thirsty? Maybe. If you put images up on a motion picture screen of somebody in a desert, and which they did do in England when I was there, they'd have commercials in the movie theater, and you'd see someone, you know, in the desert, and then someone would show up with an orange drink, and sure. yeah, these images are images have an effect on you, sure. and so I don't doubt that. Now, whether there are these secret images being put forward that we're actually noticing. And they're actually having an effect on us. Well, as you say, there's a varying trains of thought here. But for those people who can profit on it, which you would say are the advertisers, I don't think they use it that much. Right. And I don't think it's a very highly developed technology. I think, you know, flashing pictures in front of you. I even think that subliminal advertising, in other words, the flashing of one-frame images or words in a commercial, I believe that was banned in the United States.
Yeah, I've heard that as well.
I don't know whether that's true, but obviously, as a filmmaker, as someone who's worked on films, I'm always thinking of how to have an effect on the audience. You're trying to trick the audience or show them something that maybe they think they saw, or you're always playing and manipulating your audience. It's just natural.
So, did you not have any success in the animation world with trying to bring about levels of thought or ways of thinking, so you moved to radio?
No, not really. How I came to CKLN 8 years ago, much to everyone's chagrin, I guess, to some people's chagrin, it was really because I used to listen to I used to listen to Bob, and.
Right.
I listened to other things on CKLN, but to me, the most interesting material that was presented was what Bob did. And
it was a subliminal.
And at the time, as Bob was saying, the people with whom he was working were and who are big media people in the business today, some of them are big in the sense that they have a job and yeah. And influence things and work with George Anthony, who wrote that review of 200 Motels that we heard earlier on. In the show from 1971, Bob was belittled for bringing this information to people at the time, and yet to me it was the most
driven out of the country.
Yeah, he was driven out of the country. I found it the most fascinating stuff because he was finding these what would appear to be underground figures who were really doing a lot of analysis of the media, like Mabe Russell, Dave Emery. Dr. Beter, Lyndon LaRouche, and so on. We heard things that we'd never get to hear anywhere else, which was what
right.
I guess the whole point of CKLN was. I don't think the only thing that you're hearing from me are things, I don't know whether they're things you wouldn't hear of anything anywhere else, but I guess I don't necessarily copy things from the mainstream media all the time and present it to you. They're often eclectic ideas, things from our audience.
Why do you do it though? Like, why give up your time on Sunday morning? I guess that's my question.
That's a good.
You're going with a whole theme here. Like, you're going back to Disney 3 hours ago when you started, giving us an outline or whatever. And it's all about. There are a couple points that you made in that when you were reading that about, you know. Creating, like you said, he has Disney World or Disneyland. It's like a whole other world. It's like a Vatican City. And it's really about, for lack of a better term, mind control or control, period. If you can create you can create an atmosphere. So I'm wondering now if you are doing that here with the radio.
Well, when I
and
first...
And then when you get into the I can't pronounce anything.
The tachistoscope, yes.
Tachistoscope.
Right.
It's all connected. So I'm wondering now whether you feel that way. Because, again, 10 minutes ago you asked me if I was a Stalinist. why would that be important unless you want me to be one? So I'm wondering now whether this is a sequel after you've left animation and now you're in radio.
Well,
and on the computer with the internet.
Well,
I'm the subliminal here. Greg can't. He tried to get me off the air. I'm still here. I'm overt subliminal.
Well, I think I'm very much a follower. I think of the reason that I look to good leader. The reason I talk about people who are leaders is that, in a sense, I am looking for one. You know, and I find people that I would like Kim Jong Il or President or Fidel Castro or Chavez. I mean, I admire that kind of thing. I admire that sort of leadership and Disney.
So you
as well.
Just want to be a part of it. Then.
I mean, I don't admire Hitler. I mean, Hitler is completely off the deep end.
Well,
I mean,
he was a radio man.
He was a radio man, right, and that
is
a problem.
Subliminal.
I'm fighting.
The guy's repeating the subliminal.
Yeah, that he was a radio man. So a radio man. So I love doing.
He's a radio man.
The thing is, I mean, maybe it's subliminal why I even came to radio. I was always interested in radio. I have old tapes that I unearthed and have transferred recently that show how really deeply interested I was in radio when I was also interested in animation. And of course they are combined in a way. If you watch an episode of Rocky and Bullwinkle, I mean, it's been called illustrated radio. It's you could listen to Rocky and Bullwinkle and know exactly what went on. You wouldn't have to see it, whereas an animated cartoon, look away from it, like a Chuck Jones cartoon, a Roadrunner or something like that. You would never know what was happening in that cartoon if you weren't looking at it. But Rocky and Bullwinkle, you could listen to it and get an impression of what was going on. And I think that I saw all aspects of sound, picture, art, literature combined in the animated medium. And this obviously fascinated me in a sense. And also I was fascinated by the idea that when I was a child, I saw Popeye or Bugs Bunny or something like that. They seemed very real to me, even though instinctively or intuitively I knew that they were drawings, but they seemed to be beyond that level. It was, you know, that kind of a cartoon was meant to make you believe in the characters because they moved so convincingly and they seemed like they acted like a human being, even though they might have been an animal. And so I still find that medium very, very interesting, and except that I don't think that really interesting things are going on in that medium, and it's hard to work in a business where the majority of the product that's being produced is terrible. Now, the same thing could be said for radio.
I think that a lot of times people get caught up in the technology itself rather than what it can be used for.
Right.
It's like with the Mumbai shootings last week, they're talking about how they were communicating with BlackBerries. If I'm a terrorist, I'm trying to shoot people. If I'm one of these guys, I'm thinking in the planning stages, I'm thinking, well, you know, we can use this to coordinate our horrific attacks. Most people wouldn't even think, like, what I'm saying is that when the news anchor is saying this, you know, it's astonishment that people could use it for that, because, you know, people just want to have a BlackBerry so they can show their friends.
Right.
You know, I was watching Dancing with the Stars last night or whatnot, or that's the limit of most people's communications, and they have all these wonderful devices. But those guys could use it for something else. So I guess my bigger point is that you can always use various mediums for a lot of different things. And I just wanted to know whether you thought the subliminal hypnotizing was part of it.
I think it's always been a bit of one of our jokes here on the show was that we only had about five listeners. I mean, Bob said, they were telling him that he should go out in the street and talk to people because more people would hear him. And in a sense, he's probably true. When we were out of here for 14 months and we'd be standing across the street in the cold protesting our dismissal, you know, I felt sometimes we met more people there than we may be influenced on the radio.
Another thing about radio is that it's very anonymous. I think a lot more people listen to you all than you may think, or maybe you're just trying to be humble. But with a lot of the topics that you guys bring up, a lot of the people that you talk about, there are people out in society, again, who will agree, but they can't necessarily come out and say, I agree with you. because right. of whatever their family or their employment situation or whatever. They're just ashamed.
Yeah, there's a lot of fear and terrorism in our society. A lot of people will not do what they know to be the right thing because if they do it, if they're known to have done something, to stand on the line about something is literally death in our society. You yeah. think you will lose the things that you hold most dear, the things that you love the most, you will lose.
Blackberry.
If you go against, if you stand up for what you really believe in, and when you have the chance to do it.
That's a subliminal.
I experienced that this morning. I had someone, you know, that said, I can't do something for you because I will, you know, I'll lose something that I love. And
we are out here.
Yeah. I want to just, there's another question you brought up. I just want to talk a little bit about my, the evolution of the program. When I first came here, I saw myself just doing what the previous host had done. In other words,
right.
I would come in, I would say, hello, this is Greg Duffel, and here is Counterspin from New York City. And I'd put in there'd be a CD ready, I'd hit that, and then I'd just sit back for a half an hour. And then that CD would end, and I would go, oh, and here's another Counterspin from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting from New York City. And I'd hit the button, and I'd play that. And what would happen between that would be people would phone in and speak to me. And I thought I'd just sit back, and no one would react to that. No one would phone in. And suddenly people were phoning and talking to me about politics or this or that while this in this hour-long period where I was at the studio.
Correct.
And then I remember about a year after this, Danny wasn't with me at the time on the show, and I was at Daniel's parents' place, and we're sitting around in the garden, and Danny, I just casually mentioned that I was doing this radio show, that I was going in every week, and I spent about 8 hours putting this show together, and I, you know, at that point I was doing little interviews and things like that that I would supplement with this other material. And Danny just said, "You got to take calls. You got to do this. You got to have a website. You got to do all these things with this show." I mean, he saw it as something that, you know, that I should be putting a lot of effort in, that it was important. And I said, "Whoa, wait a minute. I've already put 8 hours into this show
yeah.
as it stands. I can't imagine putting in any more." And of course, eventually, we were putting in. In fact, this week I sat down and I started to go back in time and looking at material that I hadn't gone over. And this is literally at this point, it's hundreds of hours of material of stuff that I recorded for some purpose and never got to. And I sat down and I started working on it, and I realized that in order to do the show to my satisfaction, I'd need a staff of people, and I would need to spend 40 hours myself doing it. And I'd have to have other people working on it too, to do it really properly. It's a frightening realization to come to. But, you know, what Danny hooked into about taking calls, and with what I didn't realize when I was sitting there playing these Counterspins, and people aren't listening. They're listeners to the radio. They know I'm there, but they want to talk to me privately.
Right.
And what is that a sign of? They're not interested in the pre-recorded material. They want to hear somebody in their community, in a studio in downtown Toronto, talking about their thoughts, their experiences, and bringing in people from who are listening if they want to speak to a certain topic. If you beat the bushes and they make the call to 416-595-1655, that was what was missing. And where did that and Bob also explored those two ends of it earlier on. There was the international connection, which mainly played pre-recorded material of Americans that we could never normally hear. There was no internet. You couldn't just go and look for things on the internet and find it like you can today. Your radio station was the place where you could hear this stuff. The then Bob went and did this Mike Dyer program where for 2 hours on a Wednesday late at night, early Thursday morning, there would be this happening that would occur where Bob and Mike Dyer and these strange sound effects and noises and inexplicable things would happen, and people would phone in and talk about things that you didn't understand. Bob would say things that were incomprehensible for the most part, and then sometimes it would veer into something that you would understand. And it was, to me, it was just fascinating. And I remember when I first came to CKLN, in my audition, I guess, when I came to say I would volunteer, I'd come in on a Sunday morning and do this program. One of the things I said was, I've got all these old recordings of old CKLN shows. And I thought they'd go, wow, really? You do? And I thought, yeah, and I can use them. And they looked at me like going, oh, okay. They weren't that interested. They didn't think that was as interesting as I thought it was. And yeah. And eventually I did play some of these things on the air to whether people liked it or didn't. I don't know. They were interesting to me. Ultimately, when you're doing a show, you are thinking of your audience. When I get an email from somebody and they say that they're not enjoying the program, it hurts me a bit. You know, I want them to enjoy it. But on the other hand, I have to be bound by my interests. I can't put on stuff that I'm not interested in or say things that I don't really believe in. Like,
well,
I don't.
If you're not into it, we as the audience will pick that up.
Yeah, there was a guy on who was on this station who would come on and say that Iran would be blown up imminently, and. Right. He'd give a date. You know, next Tuesday, Iran will be blowing up. And this is patently ridiculous because it would never be addressed the following week why Iran wasn't blowing up. And if it was addressed, the person would say, it's because I said so on the air, and that stopped them from doing it.
Yeah.
Now, that's just inane. And
Who was that, Greg? Who was that?
It was a guy named Vijay Sharma. To my way of looking at it, it's inane, and it falls into line with a lot of these radio guys who come on with a deep voice saying, "You know, Iran's going to get toppled. America's going to go in and invade Iran on Thursday, and you better believe this and go to my website, print and plan, blah blah blah. 9/11 never happened. And so on and so on and so forth. And and that's their shtick." That is their shtick. And I guess there's a certain shtick to what I do, because if you met me, you'd think, well, that's not the Greg I know on the air, maybe. But the thing is that I really think that I'm putting out what – I can only put out what I am. If I'm doing the program, I try to represent, at least at times, it must be me. At other times, it isn't. But – and when I put on another voice, of course, I'm putting on another persona, or I'm trying to make it more evocative for the audience. And
well, let me tell you that a lot of the way you described your reactions to listening to Bob and Mike and whoever was before you is a lot of the same way I feel listening to you all. I think it's fascinating to hear this condensed capsule of a lot of stuff that you're not going to hear on mainstream radio or see on mainstream TV or any kind of mainstream media.
Yeah, and it's not even some that I'm picking things that aren't in the mainstream media. Sometimes we talk about things that are.
Well, things that are in the mainstream media, but things that people don't notice that, you know, like you say, he just said what? You know.
Well, and it's also that because the show is only normally it's only 2 hours long. In this case, I mean, this conversation would never have occurred on the air had it not been for the fact that the next host, for some reason, has not arrived. And
maybe people serve some purpose sometimes, I guess.
And so, and a lot of the time that, you know, it's hard to get, unless you're just giving a bunch of headlines, you have a half an hour long program, you can't get into anything in depth. You're just saying, oh, this happened or that happened. I mean, some people used to come in here, and it appeared like they had nothing prepared. And they would just go online while they were on the air and search Google News.
Yeah.
And to me, I that would drive me crazy. That's real desperation. I mean, whether it appears like it or not, I have to do a certain amount of preparation. And
you want it to be of a certain quality if you're going to stamp your name on it.
Well, yeah, and also I feel insecure. It's like not getting your homework done. And like for instance this. Yesterday I pulled now this hasn't even hit the air. I don't even know when I'm going to use it. I pulled 20 – this shows my lack of maybe organizational ability. I pulled these 27 or 30-some-odd clips from a George Bush press conference. I'll play one.
Well, that's exactly what they've been trying to do for the past 4 years.
Now – Now, why did I pull that? I'm thinking, oh, I'll use that as a little clip, maybe to play for some reason or another at some point. But then again, I pulled this.
I'd like to ask you about Russia. The Democratic candidates, when asked about the new Russian leader, Dmitry Medvedev, didn't appear to know a great deal about him. I wonder what you can say about him, how much power you think he's really got with Putin still in the picture. And, you know, critics would say you badly misjudged Vladimir Putin. Mm. So what would be your cautionary tale to your successor about the threat Russia poses and how to deal with this new leader?
I don't know much about Medvedev either. And what'll be interesting to see is who comes to the, who represents Russia at the G8, for example. It'll be interesting to see. It'll help, I think, give some insight as to how Russia intends to conduct foreign policy.
So that's a clip from a February news conference that I'm just getting around to listening carefully and looking through. And on that note, this week I received an email from somebody about Fidel Castro talking about Medvedev, and I like this guy. I like this Medvedev, and I felt really satisfied that Fidel Castro wrote this. In the past few weeks, I had watched him in numerous functions as president of the Russian Federation following the aggravation of the financial crisis battering the world. The Russian Federation is one of the most powerful states in the international community, despite the dismemberment of the USSR. The Russian president's addresses are clear and precise, and he tends to be brief. He does not avoid any issue, and he responds to every question. He is knowledgeable and persuasive, and he is respected even by those who disagree with him. He expressed his wishes to talk with me during his visit. It was an honor for me, and I was sure it would be a pleasant meeting, because Medvedev went both to meet with Chavez and then went to meet with Raul Castro and, obviously, Fidel Castro. And the last few months, this is getting back to Fidel Castro here, the last few months have seen amazing changes in new situations. The Yankees have launched their illegal actions on South Ossetia and Abkhazia, two countries that have nothing to do with Georgia, which has been armed to the teeth by the United States. It was this was a country that encouraged and trained the men and supplied the weapons to attack the Russian forces legally there to prevent the ongoing bloodshed. So he goes on. Anyway, what I'm glad to see is that Fidel Castro likes this Medvedev as much as I do. So I have good feeling about him, even though I guess he isn't a communist, but he looks like he's leaning more towards the Castros and Chavez's of the world. Let's hope he's on the level. But
hey, Greg,
yeah.
Greg, since we're ending soon, I just want to make some points. I've been thinking for an hour.
Yeah.
Do you realize that the whole show is consistent? We started off talking about Disney and what effect did he have on the population, the difference between mass education and highbrow stuff. Then we get into McLuhan and the effects of media environments. Then we get into subliminal advertising. It's all the question about who's influencing what.
And hey, that's like what I was saying.
Zappa, mm-hmm. Let me just say this. I like what Zappa used to say when he was in the debates in the mid-'80s over censorship.
Yeah.
He said, if lyrics had an effect on people, he says, back in the 50s, we heard nothing but love songs. How come everybody's not in love?
Right.
Which is a good question. And then you think, well, a lot of people in the 60s starting to have sex beyond normal standards up to that point. What is love? Is it sex? Is it an emotional thing? It's so confusing that you can't tell who's hypnotizing who. And that's what that article showed, the doubleness of the article. You can be on the anti-Tichkinson soap side or the pro-Tichkinson soap side. It's an endless discussion about who's controlling and what's controlling who.
Yeah.
But I guess that's life. You know, you got...
That's life.
Yeah.
It's a back and forth. The rain comes down, and then the sun dries it up. It goes up into clouds, and then it comes down again once it gets heavy enough, and then the sun dries it up, and it goes back up in the clouds.
Well, there is no definitive answer.
Replaying that. Our media are replaying that cycle.
There is no definitive answer. There's all kinds of trains of thought of people, and they all have come to different conclusions, and we have to draw our own, and then those are subject to change. So anybody who has a fossilized viewpoint on anything is going to be a pain to get along with, probably, unless they're absolutely right about something fundamental.
But you do have to have a point of view when you have a job. You're Greg Duffel. You show up. You got to maintain some kind of identity to get paid.
What do you mean paid?
As you get some money.
Where's the money?
Oh, well, it's different now. The digital new medium changed that and evaporated money.
Yeah.
Now we have problems over that.
So yeah. I guess one of the questions you ask is, why do I do it? I started to do it, and then I got hooked into it, and it's part of my life. But
Danny had an influence. Danny gave you new ideas, and then having him with you, it changed the whole show by 2003.
Yeah, because we decided to... We saw that there was... We both came to the conclusion that there was a need for this, that people needed to speak. As I said, I looked in the... We're given this handbook. And do you know that someone had the audacity to put in that handbook that only one show on this station could take calls? And that all other calls had to be left on a voicemail service? Imagine you've got a full radio station operating, 168 hours a week, and yet somewhere buried in this tomb of rules and regulations and guidelines and suggestions and edicts and so on, it says only this show can have calls. It shows when I first started here, and Danny says, "Oh, you got to take calls," and I said, "Oh, the International Connection never took calls." It was like, you can't do it. I didn't know why it didn't take calls. It's just it didn't. So
you evolved once you got to... you came to CKLN with one idea, and it changed over time.
Yeah. Okay, we got to run.
Okay.
Okay, thanks a lot for your call. Very interesting.
No problem.
Okay.
Do you know him, Greg?
No, I don't know who that is. So we're going to go out with Willie the Pimp, I guess.
That's a good time.
I guess I got to play these. We're going to go to these, and then Mariah's up next. Semper Doris, nice to see her. What's your name? What? Jocelyn. Jocelyn is here. Jocelyn is here with Mariah. They're going to do Semper Doris. Thank you, Bob, for being with us. Thank you, audience, for sticking in with me and us. And
send that hate email. We can use it next time.
Yeah, please. InternationalConnection@rogers.com. We love the hate stuff. And I guess we'll be back next week. We'll see. You never know.
Pimp for Stalinism.
Yeah. And goodbye.